name's Dale Will, and I work with the Pitkin County Open Space and Trails Program. Been at that for a while, and have become fascinated in the history of the valley. As everyone probably knows, we are also in the midst of planning for a trail to be built from Carbondale to Crested Butte, hopefully. And people that are interested in that process, I invite you to put your names on the sign-up sheet in the back on the way out if you haven't done it yet. In the next few weeks, we will be releasing maps that have keyed information about the wildlife, the engineering, the cost of construction, the history, all of those things. And we're hoping that everyone will take the time to read it all carefully, and essentially everyone can design their own trail. That's not what we're going to do tonight. So anyone that's come here tonight thinking that we're going to have a discussion about what we should do in the future, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to look backwards to see how we got to where we are today. And with the research that Open Space has been doing, as well as the historical knowledge of my guests, I hope to have a pretty interesting evening. We are each going to talk a bit, and then we also want to have an interactive time with all of you, and if other people have stories or photographs or anything that can help add to the story of this history, we want to make sure that we try to capture that as well. First thing I want to do is introduce my good buddy here and neighbor, fellow that many of you know already, and veteran of the many years of service with the National Forest, and now the head of the Frontier Museum in Glenwood, Bill Kite.
Thank you, Dale. Thank you for being here tonight. First lesson is the protocol when you're speaking before Native American, who's also a sun dancer, is I turn the floor over to him. So I'd like to introduce Kenny Frost, who I worked with for 20 years on the U-Trail project. Kenny?
Thank you, Bill. Bill and Bill Kite, those of you who don't know him, was the U.S. Forest Service archaeologist. We worked on the U-Trail project on the White River National Forest. Took us about 20 years to locate it, to find it, to find the sacred and special places of the Ute people. I am Ute, drove up from Ignacio this morning, or today, stopped at the Ute Council Tree, and for those of you who know a little bit of the Ute tribe and the special places of the Ute people, the Ute Council Tree, just to let you know, is going to be chopped down tomorrow, or cut down tomorrow.
Ooh.
It is one of the places where Chief Uray and Chipeta and many of the Utes sat in the Delta area underneath the tree. The Ute Trail also travels close by the Ute Council Tree, as well as the Uncompahgre Fort that held the Utes long ago. I have a map that's over here on the left hand, to the right of me, and or to the left if you're looking, depending which way you want to look. It shows the Ute Trail all over Colorado. The Ute Trail is colored in red, so it gives you a good idea of how the Utes utilize the Ute Trail, kind of like our superhighways of today. And believe it or not, many of our roads or highways, railroad tracks, are on top of the Ute Trail. And when we're looking for the Ute Trail, one of the things that we said is, how do we know they didn't go down through a valley or up on top of the mountains? Well, it's just like each and every one of you guys going to go hiking, you pick the easiest route, right? Native people were the same way. They took the easiest route, but yet a route that was carefully hidden sometimes in some cases. An example of this is we were walking on the Ute Trail up to Flat Tops, and the archaeologist and some of the volunteers said, well, how do we know this is the Ute Trail? But you can see the trail cutting right through the trees. And I said, that is the Ute Trail. And of course, you know, we're all taught scientifically. We got to know exactly. We have to ask these questions. And I told him, I said, okay, listen. Everybody got quiet, and you could hear bells making noise. And there were sheep walking by on that same trail we just got off. That the sheep herders today are keeping the Ute Trail alive. Now another thing too, I'm gonna tell each and every one of you, because I know many of you go hiking out there. And oftentimes the Ute Trail and the sheep herders are keeping the trail alive since the late 1800s, but when sheep were introduced into Colorado, there's drawings on aspen trees. Wherever there's drawings on aspen trees or you see a corridor cut right through an area, you're on the Ute Trail. Because the sheep herders I just mentioned are keeping that trail alive. So one, the Ute Trail today is a living being trail. It's still used today. The other thing too, each and every one of you who go hiking out there in the woods, you are also walking on the Ute Trail. So my ancestors may not be here today, but you're also keeping the Ute Trail alive today without knowing it. Now, one of the things I'm gonna mention, and it's very important to understand this. The Ute Trail, according to the map, is all over. Boulder has the Ute Trail, many of their trails, bike trails, horseback trails on top of the Ute Trail. Highway at Rocky Mountain National Park is also on top of the Ute Trail going down into Granby. Just because the Ute Trail traverses private land, Forest Service land, state land, doesn't mean that that land's gonna be taken away from you. In some cases, that trail has added value to people's land, believe it or not. So there's plus. And then a lot of times with the fear, we always say, well, we don't know who's coming to walk that trail because there could be vandalism and all that stuff. Yes, that's true. But remember, Colorado's still in the West. We're still fortunate enough today to sometimes leave our car open, our homes open. So we're still fortunate. We don't have that worry. So that's one thing that I know a lot of you may have questions, as that is always in the back of our mind, even in my mind too, living on the res, but you know, I live on the res, I don't rock the house. But those are some of the questions, and they're legitimate questions. But the other thing too is that my ancestors are not here today, the Ute people. I'm not up here often enough to get to walk the land. Each and every one of you who enjoyed the country, because this area was once the heart of Ute country. This area was once a part of the Ute reservation. Aspen was once called Ute City. And I had fortune enough to be welcomed up to by the different historical society of Aspen to talk, so I'm always grateful to them to always bring me up there to talk to people who want to listen about the Utes. The other thing too is, as I mentioned, my ancestors are not here. It's your responsibility to take care of the lands just as our ancestors, my Ute ancestors would have long ago. You're the caretakers now. And just like the Utes long ago, we always wanted to always not make war. Because Chief Uray, as I mentioned with the Ute Council Tree, he lived in Santa Fe. He saw the influx of Spaniards coming into Santa Fe area and knew that there was a big migration of people out there, the steamrolling effect, which we saw happening in history, come west and eventually annihilated a lot of native tribes. So he didn't want that to happen. So it was better to make peace and to live in our own traditional territorial lands today. The Ute people are fortunate enough to still be in their territorial lands. Sadly, what happened at Meeker, the Northern Utes who were force marched into Utah are not in Colorado anymore. But they do come here to these lands and get to enjoy it. So I want to make that clear to you that you're the caretakers of these lands that my ancestors loved and cherished. So we're going to go right into this. I'll turn this back over to Bill and we'll get Will to Odell started.
Thanks, Kenny. For those of you that don't... For those of you who don't know me and my experience in trails, I thought I'd just give a brief bio for that. In 1979, I was fortunate enough to, with Mike Marshall, archaeologist friend, to hike the entire length of the Jornada de Muerto, which is part of the Camino Real, the Chihuahua Road from Chihuahua to Santa Fe. And it had never been looked at before by archaeologists. And we spent 4 days in April 1979 hiking that trail. A lot of experiences I'd have to have a couple Irish whiskeys and a few beers to tell you about, but especially when we ran out of water and had to drink alkali water. We also learned a lot from after we hiked it. We did low sun angle flights. And what that is you get in an airplane and you fly right before the sun comes up, and you'll see any swell, any kind of a depression or swell in the land shows up as a shadow. And so we were looking for the trail segment that way to map it accurately on maps, 7.5 minute topo maps. But the problem was all of a sudden we're getting a line of mesquite trees instead of what we were looking for. And it took a while to figure out that the oxen and the carts that the Spanish used were fed mesquite beans. And I'll leave the rest to your imagination. So when you're studying trails, you always have to expect the unexpected. The next project I worked on was the Chaco Roads project, and that's an amazing project of a number of years where a bunch of us scientists got together and looked at the evidence for a north road and a south road and what that meant. And I was fortunate enough to be at Pierre's Ruin and with a plane table and Allodate much before your fancy GPS equipment mapped the Pierre's Ruin, the Acropolis, as we call it. And archaeologists always get a chance to name things, so that's one of the names that we used. And that whole project was really interesting. It prepared me for coming to Colorado after I'd also worked on the Zuni Salt Lake Trail, which was a sacred trail. With a lot of offerings, you'd come along the trail, you'd find turquoise and coral and eggshell, where they'd stop to make an offering. So those kind of things prepared me in a way for the Ute Trail, but nothing prepared me for that because it was a lot more obscure. And to show you a little bit about what we did with maps, we'll be looking at a lot of Hayden's expedition maps. We took a simple thing, we just took the map, the atlas, took a copy of it, put it on an old opaque projector, and put it on the wall, and then adjusted it to 7.5 minute topo size and plotted a lot of the trail before we ground-proofed it. And then in this area, I did work on Dexter Park Wagon Road and a lot of the re-photography of George Sudworth, who was the first government agent who reported to Congress about the resources in this area. It was my privilege to work on that project and re-photograph some of those places. So you'll see some re-photography today. Just want to give you a background a little bit. I don't know much about trails, but I'm learning all the time. So.
Yeah, if you believe that,
yeah.
This is going to be easy. Well, so we've got a bunch of images here that we're gonna go through, and all of us can join in on this. Before I get into them, I want to thank all the historic societies in our watershed, the Aspen Historic Society, the Mount Sopris Historic Society is co-hosting this event, the Redstone Historic Society, the Marble Historic Society, and the Frontier Museum have all contributed images, and this archival collection is pretty special. Oh, and the Denver Public Library. So without the archivists, a lot of this wouldn't be possible to do. I always like to go back to source documents, and yes, Kenny, I was trained to always have a footnote, so we try to do that. And one incredible source document that we have in Colorado is this atlas that Ferdinand Hayden put together. The field work was done in 1873 and 1874, though the atlas wasn't published until 1881. This photograph is a picture of the copy they have up at the Aspen Historic Society, and anyone that wants to go look at this source material can go up there and see it. There's only a few copies of this left around. There's one in Denver, and there's one down in Fort Lewis. And Kenny's map over here is one of the maps out of the Hayden Atlas. But one thing he did for us was marked all the trails in the mountains that he found in 1873. Well, guess what? In 1873, this whole part of Colorado was the Ute Reservation. So we have detailed maps of where a lot of these trails are. The trail down the Crystal started here, which is Schofield Pass. And in Hayden's report to Congress in 1873, he noted that he found a trail that came over Monarch Pass and down the Gunnison Valley and up over through where Crested Butte is today, over Schofield, down Rock Creek to the Grand River, and down the Grand River to modern-day Grand Junction. And Hayden described it as one of the primary Indian trails in the Colorado Territory that came right through here. I know Penny's got some stories about some of this country, and jump in if you want me to stop talking, stomp on my foot or something. In our valley, there's also detailed maps in the Hayden Survey. As often happens when you want to go for a hike with an old USGS quad, you find yourself on the boundary of several different maps, and the same is true here. The Roaring Fork watershed has pieces of four different maps in the detailed maps in the survey. But what I did is photograph the pieces that pertain to Rock Creek, now known as the Crystal River. And you can see the trail came up over Schofield, followed Rock Creek down, jumping maps, came down into present-day Carbondale and onto Glenwood and down the Grand River Valley. But one of the things that's interesting about the location specifically of the trail is it followed up through Carbondale and up the east side of the Crystal for quite a ways, and then it starts jumping back and forth depending on what the landforms were up the Crystal. And as we get into the wagon road maps, you'll see that, not surprisingly, someone's job is to go build a wagon road. They're going to follow the trail that was there, and that's how this evolution started to happen. This is a photograph of what the Hayden Survey Party looked like, and I understand that Chief Uray gave them immunity to be in the reservation, and they were able to pass through the country without any trouble. Not sure he'd make the same decision if he'd known what was coming, but in any event, these guys were allowed to come in and do detailed surveys at a time when this land was still under the sovereignty of the Ute Nation. I got to fly it recently, and this is looking down valley from around Perham Creek, down the lower part of the Crystal to Carbondale, and then on down the Roaring Fork to the Grand Valley, now known as the Colorado River Valley. One of the historical records that we have is a little book that's up in the Pitkin County Library. It has a report, the book was published in 1950, interviewed some of the original homesteaders in the valley who could remember teepees in Faloha Meadows, and we first published that in our management plan for Faloha, but I think about it every time I go by there. So here we are, here's the dotted line showing the eastern boundary of the Ute Reservation. Here's the Roaring Fork watershed here, the trail up the Crystal and over Schofield. There was another trail up the Roaring Fork. Interestingly, they did not like steep river canyons, and Kenny was explaining that they're hard to get through. They went up Soper's Creek over to Capitol Creek and over Watson Divide, and that was the original View Trail route into Aspen. Now these two characters were both involved in the uprising at Meeker, and one gentleman was named Antelope, and then this is Chief Colorado, and they were both involved in that, and I'm going to let Kenny talk about how they got out of there.
One of the interesting things was Meeker is, hour and a half drive from here, northwest Colorado. Antelope is said to have killed Nathan Meeker, the Indian agent. Chief Colorado is said to have killed Thornburg, Colonel Thornburg, who came up through the Thornburg battle site over there. And basically, the Utes wiped out 248 soldiers while trained with the Gatling gun from a high perched area of 28 Utes. According to oral history, history books has it the other way around, but it's up to you to decide which one you would rather believe. The other interesting part too was the Utes had the repeater rifles. The Army had single shot. So with the repeaters, it was basically a chicken shoot because of the rapid firing. So what happened was Colorado and some of the Utes came across the flat tops on the Ute Trail, down into Glenwood, down up through here, through Carmel, all the way up over on top and hit up on the Crested Butte side of the mountain and hid there. During that duration of time, another group of Utes took off to the Grand Mesa over by Grand Junction, and with Nathan Meeker's wife and some of the ladies, and basically hid out there until runners from Uncompahgre, where Chief Urey was camped, sent runners and told everybody, you guys give up, kind of thing. And so they gave up, and then the Utes were captured at Grand Junction, force marched up to Vernal, what is presently Fort Duchesne, Utah, and Vernal area.
And there's a fairly new book out, we'll have it up here if you want to copy the reference, called Troubled Trails. It's by a journalist and his historian, Robert Selvernick. There you go, that's it. And it's really interesting about that period of time.
Well, unfortunately, as a result of that incident in Meeker, Governor Pitkin led the cry to do away with this reservation. And in fact, by the time the Atlas was published depicting the reservation was gone. Yeah. It's ironic. So then what happened? Well, white prospectors had been trespassing into the watershed for some years, but with the elimination of the reservation, there was an influx of settlers into the valley. I don't know if Jason Sewell is here, but he thought he might come, and he is descended from one of the original patentees of the place they have up at Thompson Creek. So the county of Pitkin was then formed, and one of the major functions of counties in that period of time was to build roads in this newly acquired land that was in more or less a wilderness condition at the time. And the first Pitkin County assessor was told to walk up the trail up the Crystal looking for property that that might owe taxes, and got to the what was called the Cloud Ranch at the confluence with Coal Creek, turned around, went back down to Avalanche, went up over Hell Roaring Pass, and 2 weeks later got to Aspen and published an editorial in the paper saying that if they wanted them to do any more tax assessing up to Crystal, they needed to build a wagon road. And indeed, they did. So the plats of this road are in the county archives. And here's the legend off of one of those plats. There's three pages of beautiful maps. They're 3x3 on canvas. And so we started analyzing those maps to see what they had. Here's what one of the pages looks like. They actually have survey calls all the way up and down the Crystal from the Roaring Fork all the way to the Gunnison County line, and we were able to take a GPS unit and follow survey calls, and we think we know pretty much exactly where this road was. Now, this is the first piece of it that's still relatively in its original state, and this is right up the road from Wayne Ives' house. I saw Wayne walk in. Potato Bill Road up in that Seven Oaks subdivision is actually a piece of this old wagon road. If you follow the surveys back towards Carbondale, they follow pretty much the alignment of this Ute Trail. They came around by the fish hatchery up the Prince Creek Road. The lower part of it is a remnant of this wagon road up as far as Flying Dog Ranch, where instead of turning up the Prince Creek canyon there, the wagon road, and I assume the Ute Trail, kept going straight up that side of the valley and eventually connected from where the Flying Dog Ranch is into the Seven Oaks subdivision where we pick it up here. One of my great unexpected pleasures recently was getting up there with Kenny and walking along it and thinking about all of this history. So I've been collecting historic photographs, and this one came out of the Crystal River Pictorial, a book about the railroad, and trying to match the locations where these pictures were taken. And we're going to go on a little trip up the Crystal now, and we're going to bounce around in the period of time between 1873 and about 1905. So forgive me, because it's hard to go linear in a time sequence and also a geographical sequence, and I chose geography, so here we go. Moving up the Crystal, this is a map that came out of the Surveyor General's office. You want to talk about those maps?
No.
Okay. Well, they came out of the federal government, and the General Land Office was the predecessor of the BLM, and their job was to keep track of patents of land that had recently been taken away from the Ute people, and now it was owned by the federal government, and it started being patented out. So these General Land Office maps, they tried to keep up to date with who owned what, and this is the one from 1890 coming up the Crystal. So you can see here comes the wagon road. One thing I love about these GLO maps is they name the cabins. Well, this cabin sits right at the confluence with Nettle Creek. Those three ponderosa pines are there today. This house was recently owned by Mike Brinson, who gave me this photograph. But it's rare to find photos of the wagon road that predate the railroad. But this is one such photo, and those trees are still there. Another interesting thing to note on this map is this bridge location that they're calling Red Wings. So we'll go up and see where that was. Here's where the wagon road and then the railroad went past Nettle Creek. They had a flume that came off of Nettle Creek, and they could fill the steam engines here, and that was the last place they could fill the steam engines until they got to Marble. And I understand that they would occasionally run out of water somewhere around the Darien's place up there, and they would have to uncouple the freight they were hauling and coast the engines into Marble, fill them up, and come back and get the cars. This is next to what we now call Marble Rapid. It's on an open space called Red Wind Point. That piece of land has been named Red Wine, Red Wing, Red Wine Death. There we go. So who knows what the first name was, but you'll see various iterations of that. Now this is a petition for some people that got, by some people that got pretty mad at the railroad. And I'm gonna jump forward and come back. The wagon road had come up around two Red Wind Point, and then there's a bridge here that's indicated on the map, and they crossed to the other side, and this is the location, and the road where it came across is still on the land, so you can line that up. Well, as part of the planning for the trail to come, the open space staff has been going up and down the valley with wildlife biologists and highway engineers and an archaeologist. And the archaeologist took one look at this rock face and said, that's not naturally. The railroad blew the end of that cliff off, which makes sense because the wagon builders got there and bridged it. Well, the railroad, as everyone probably knows, has a platform that goes around the base of that cliff that was created out of the rock that they blew up. And if you look at it now, you can really see the rock around the edges of that is all varnished and it's a different color. But the tip of Red Wine Point was created with dynamite.
Wow.
Just up the river from that, now the wagons are crossed over onto what's become the Highway 133 alignment. This is a McClure photo that I got from the Denver Public Library. You can see the railroad had worked its way up the east side, and the wagon road had come up the west side. If you go to that same spot today, you'll find the landform has completely changed. This cliff here is the same one as here. Well, when they built Highway 133, they moved a lot of stuff around, and there was an interesting editorial that came out of the Denver Post in, I think it was 1969, basically saying that our highway department had ruined the Crystal Valley, would never be the same again. Now everyone's gotten used to what this looks like, but the highway is in the original bed of the river, and the river is pushed over the side, and this is one place where the railroad grade is gone because the river is now flowing right through here. So we've come up the west side of the river to another bridge crossing. This is what the County Wagon Road Survey looks like, and this is what the GLO maps look like, showing the same bridge just above Mobley's cabin. Well, Mobley was one of the people that had signed that petition. I'm going to go back to that for a second. I have something else to say about that. When the railroad was built, think about this. Pitkin County was a little county of a few hundred people, probably a budget of almost nothing. And in comes John Osgood, who at the time was reportedly the sixth wealthiest person in the world. And he wants to start bringing coal out of his valley because he owns the steel mills down in Pueblo, and starts building the railroad up the Crystal. Well, he didn't much care about the existence of the Pitkin County Wagon Road. And so when they got to Red Line Point, the railroad just knocked that bridge down. This is a petition that then ensued, signed by Mr. Mobley, among others, demanding that the county go up there and replace the bridge and break the railroad. So there was an interesting period of time where there was competition going on between the proponents of the wagon road and the proponent of the railroad.
You mean the people actually didn't get along then either? Quite. No, people either get along or we don't. So when people don't get along, they just petition. Well, we petition, right?
Yeah, just check.
Kenny's laughing about that. All right, so now we get back up to, there's Mobley's cabin, and it sits right where this bridge came back across into Janeway. I always wondered where that was. Well, using the coordinates on the wagon road survey, we found it. And they've made a big buttress with rock. It's hard to see because the trees have grown up in the old road, but it's there. And so they crossed back over to the other side, came up through Janeway. Here again is the GLO map showing the ford at Avalanche. And if you go to that spot today, you'll see by the old Janeway campground where the wagons forded, and the road is still quite visible working its way around the shady side of Elephant Mountain there. No hot springs here on the GLO map. This is where the wagon road came back around Elephant Mountain, and the railroad came straight up the side of the river and basically, once again, put itself on top of the wagon road, and I'm sure there were some interesting discussions about that too. just behind that spot where the two come together is one of the most significant remnants of the Crystal Railroad, where they cut through this buttress on the side of Elephant Mountain. And there is a photograph of a locomotive in that same spot. The wagons, meanwhile, drop down to river level just below that buttress. And where I took this picture, I'm standing at river level with that buttress pretty much straight up above me. I have to say, that's one of the most beautiful sights I've ever seen, is that lower part of the narrows down on the river there. This is what it looks like from across the river. This is the old wagon road, and once you start learning where this stuff is, you gotta watch it when you're driving, because you start looking for it. But there's a rock wall that's still there. That cut where the trains went through is up here. There were two grades that went up the narrows then. It's a lot of fun to take these old photographs and go out and try to find the exact spot where they were taken. The lenses on the cameras then were different, and so they stretch things in different ways, and you kind of have to make some guesses of exactly where it was, but I think I'm within about 10 feet of where this original photograph was taken. So here we have the wagon road was up here, the railroad here. There was a competing railroad named the Elk Mountain Railway Company that decided they were going to try to get to the Redstone area first. And there was even a thought at that time that you could have multiple railroads competing for a service in Mountain Valleys. We had, of course, we had the Midland and the Rio Grande going into Aspen. Well, the Elk Mountain never put any track down. And eventually that provided the platform for the road that became Highway 133. This is everyone's favorite spot, the Hippie Dip up the Crystal. And there's been a lot of stuff going on there for a long time. And I was really happy to have a little blessing with Kenny up at that spot a couple weeks ago. Again, we know that's a place where the teepees would be put up, and was that the youth were known for cherishing hot springs, and I'm sure that was an important spot, maybe the reason that one of their main trails went up this valley. So,
okay,
all right, we're okay. Here's a headline from the Aspen Morning Chronicle, 1888. They would report on the business of the county commissioners, and there was a motion made to pay for the construction of this wagon road up to this point. And that for $200 is what they paid, and they got it to this point right here. So I that was kind of interesting. Of course, Aloha Meadows is now a nature preserve. Bought by the Pitkin County Open Space Program. It had been slated for 4 luxury homes out in the meadow, and we were fortunate to be able to persuade the owner that maybe open space was a better option for him, and we intend to protect that forever.
This is where I'm supposed to talk. I'd like to give Dale a hard time, just kind of get him off center a little bit, you know, so he has to think what you're doing. What is that?
That's why I love you, Bill.
This is a reported place where Doc Holliday spent some time trying to recuperate from his tuberculosis in the 6 months that he was in Glenwood Springs from May 1887 to November 1887. And it's reported that his paramour, his common-law wife, Kate, Big Nose Kate, this is one of her relatives, and that she accompanied Doc when he came over by stagecoach over Independence Pass from Leadville down into Glenwood Springs in May of 1887. It's disputed history, but most of everything about Doc is, so I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, well, so here's our GLO map. This is about where Aloha Meadows is, and here's Harney's cabin on the old wagon road, pre-railroad, and I believe the report. I think Doc was up there. Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't I believe him?
Well, if you really want to hear about Doc Holliday, you can come to the New Museum in Winwood Springs.
The real Doc Holliday.
Okay, well now we are up just above the North Redstone Bridge. Another one of these beautiful McClure photographs that were provided by the Denver Public Library. And you'll notice this rock outcropping here. Well, it's still there and it still looks pretty much the same. By this point, the Elk Mountain Railroad had built their grade up this way. Again, they never put any track on it. The Crystal Railroad had built the grade up this way, and they're busily laying track on it in this photograph. And in between is a bridge, if you could call it that. A lot of these bridges, I think, back in the 1880s and 1890s were pretty basic. They would remind us of what we might find out in the National Forest today. But there it is. There's a wagon going across the Crystal River. One thing about looking at these historic photographs that is really striking is that there was not much in the way of vegetation in this period, and I'm going to ask Bill to explain why that was.
You think I know?
Okay. Yeah, I do. Believe it or not, in the late 1800s, from 1868 to the end, what is the first thing that people do in order to build a shelter?
Cut down trees.
You cut down trees. Believe it or not, have you often wondered when you go into Denver why there's no trees up there in those mountains? Because the city of Denver, or the people who resided in Denver back then, chopped down every tree that is up there at that period of time. The other thing that I also want to make mention, because we had a large influx of people in Colorado, that every animal that you see out there today is all imported from other states. Your Yellowstone elk, your deep timber elk came from different places. Skunks were imported. Every animal was imported because people needed to eat long ago. And that goes along with the trees, why it's barren. For those of you who don't know, now you know. The rest of us know.
Kenny likes to tell stories. He really is a good storyteller.
What do you mean, like, is that, okay, here we go. So we're starting.
All right. So now we're up to the little hamlet of Redstone. And this is a GLO map pre-Redstone and pre-railroad, but it shows a bridge right at the confluence of Coal Creek. Apparently in 1907, there was a heck of a flood. This photograph shows Redstone has now been constructed by Mr. Osgood, but the bridge has been washed down, and there's someone using the remains of it to go fishing. So here's what we got in a great big hurry in around 1900 was the construction of Redstone by Osgood. And there's a lot of interesting things on this map. Here again is that bridge we were just looking at. The original confluence of Coal Creek and the Crystal was about a half a mile downstream from where it is today, for reasons that still perplex me. When they built Highway 133, they decided to straighten the end of Coal Creek out and drop it right into the Crystal here. As opposed to the confluence that you can still see it if you look for it about a half mile downstream. Getting up above Redstone, this is now an open space property called the Drool, and here is where the county road went up that direction on the west side, while our friend Mr. Osgood built himself a private road up this side past his castle. And I understand there's been a lot of discussion recently about the new life of the castle, but that's all I'm going to say about that. So here we are standing at the location of that bridge. The Crystal Railroad crossed the river in the lower end of Redstone,
This was the early depot. They later built a more ornamental one. But in the same location, the open space program recently constructed what we now call, again, the depot. Danny Muse designed that for us to resemble the original train heritage of it. But it's in about the same location as the original one was. You can see the coke ovens over here, and here's this hillside here. So now we're up on the Drool. Up and down this wagon road, as you follow these coordinates, you find a lot of these surviving rock walls, which are, they're pretty cool. They were built by hand in the 1880s, and most of them are still in really good shape. On the other side, here's the road system that came through the castle. This is a bridge that's a little bit downstream out in front of the castle. And this was the private Osgood Road up the east side of the river to another bridge above where that the powerhouse was coming out of Hot Creek. Now we're, in this photograph, we're up above looking back down the other direction. That private road goes, the gatehouse used to stand right here along that road, and that county wagon road as depicted on the map is coming across here. Here's a photograph of what that wagon road looks like climbing up the far side of this. I know there's some folks here tonight that now live right up in here, the Downies, and that road that's in that neighborhood is a remnant of that wagon road. Now what's this going on here? The GLO maps above Redstone were done before the wagon road was extended above Redstone, and so they still depict the Ute Trail here, and as it is on the Hayden maps. Well, here's Hayes Creek. Every single route went past the bottom of that waterfall. The Ute, the wagons, the railroad, and the highway. That's where they all went. Nice place, huh?
I mentioned George Sudworth earlier. This is one of his photographs, the late 1800s. And again, you don't see a whole lot of trees on the right. It's nothing but trees now. And some of that you can see stumps coming up where it burned. So one of the legends or lore that I'd like to dispel was that when the Utes left this country, they started spike fires, and that's nothing but pure BS. That's not the case at all. You look at the oral history of the Utes, and you talk to the Ute people, and I just wanted to mention that that wasn't what caused that fire.
So this is right up above Hayes Falls. Here's a little snippet from the newspaper on the day that the commissioners appropriated $2,000 to pay one John Bogan to finish that wagon road from Redstone up to the county line. And now we think that's where the name Bogan Flat came from, the campground up there. So looking upstream, this photograph was taken about 15 years later than the Sudworth photo. You can see the railroad's been constructed here, and the county wagon road is going up this way. You can't even see it today in the timber that's grown in there, and whether that timber has grown back or whether it's wasn't there before. I've heard some suggest that the wildfire regime in the mountains used to leave a lot less woody material around than is the case today. So. Last point here, when they built that highway, highways, I've learned, take up a lot more room than railroads. And they pushed into the river, and they also cut into a lot of pieces of the landform. In this case, the old wagon road is right here, and where it came out around, that piece of land no longer exists because of the road cut for the highway. A lot of folks refer to this as the Bear Creek Trail or the Bunker Hill Trail, but there's Bogan's handiwork climbing that hillside there, looking back towards Sopris, looking at the Hayden surveys. I'm pretty sure that they followed right up along the Ute Trail up past Bear Creek. This is where the spot drops back down, and the trail went up around this bend. Little known fact is that the original coal strike at Placida was right over here in that bend, and if you look carefully when you drive past there, there's still a tailing pile with coal on it there now. The railroad came through here and they first went around this little knoll, later blasted their way through on the platform the highway's in today, and so you can see they were straightening things out and modifying that railroad as they went. Here's a map that's in the Crystal River Pictorial about the railroad showing how all this came about. There's the road that we were just on coming down around the side. The original railroad was built through there, and then a lot of things happened in Placida. They were having problems with methane explosions in that original coal strike that's over on the west side, so they started mining on the east side, and you can still see those tailing piles today. They eventually built a cable vernacular to haul the coal across to a tipple, and they would load it into the trains there. This is where Osgood stopped building his railroad, and the railroad that went from here into Marble was built by the marble quarry interests. Osgood gave up coal mining in 09, and the railroad was essentially absorbed by the Crystal River in San Juan for the purpose of getting marble down from the quarry. Here's the cover of the railroad book, and here's the same spot today, which is the old road going straight through the little hamlet of Placida with Chair Mountain in the background. Up and down the railroad grade, there's a lot of marble in the river, and I've heard people say it fell off the trains. Well, it didn't fall off the trains. What happened was the quarry would cut a piece, and if it cracked or had a flaw in it, they would throw it on the trains when they weren't heavily loaded, and they used it to riprap the railroad grade with. So, and we have the most exotic riprap in the world. And I want to mention that of that white marble, probably our nation's most sacred item is the Tomb of the Unknown, which rolled down those tracks in 1926, and is a place that a lot of us have a lot of awe about for what it represents in terms of people that have sacrificed and who aren't even known. So we're getting almost to the end of the slides here. The Osgood Rail also ran a line down the east side of the valley to that coal strike that was over on the east side. This is up above Placida. This is the Placida Trailhead. That's why there's a car parked there. It once upon a time had rail on it. Now we're at the base of what used to be McClure Pass. This is a neat little map that hangs on the wall of the Redstone Historic Museum. And here's the same spot in the 40s and today. This sign here, it's not quite legible on the screen, but it says Paonia 26 miles or something with an arrow that way. This McClure Pass Road was built later in time than the rest of these routes, and was once upon a time a turnoff on the road between Carbondale and Marble. It's now become the primary route of Highway 133, which was built right across the toe of that aspen grove there. The railroad had constant problems with beaver dams flooding the railroad grade, and although they used it for a road for a while, when the highway department got involved, they went around all the beaver dams. And now we're back in time. This is another Sitworth photograph. He got in, I think he was surveying before the creation of the White River National Forest, was sent in to evaluate the timber.
And all the resources.
So he was doing a resource inventory. Well, this is the base of the McClure Pass. This is right about where the Pitkin Gunnison County line is, the top of the wagon road that Pitkin County had built, it's along the Ute Trail, and on this map, this is labeled as McClure's house. So there we go. Same man that cultivated the red McClure potato and later had a farm up at Catherine's store. So that's all my slides, and I guess we can turn the lights on and talk about all this.
Again, I want to thank the Mount Soapers Historical Society, all the people from the Historical Society. Raise your hand, please. Okay. And how many people like history and enjoy it? Okay, then I ask you to vote for the historic initiative that we're going to have on the ballot in November.
Yes.
That supports historical societies so we can be the keepers of your records, of your public land, and your history. Thank you.
Yes.
So, the major public's major
way. It's measure one A. So that's it.
Okay, well, there are people in this room that I know as much about this as I do. There's one guy sitting right there that knows a lot more than I do, but anyone that has questions about her, wants to add to this tale, please. Can I call on someone? Oh, we got a hand up.
I'll speak at once.
Jesse Young is here with Open Space, is my tech savvy partner, and I don't see why we wouldn't. Can we do that?
Yeah.
Well, while I'm doing that, let me just ask the Open Space staff that are in the room to raise their hands. Jesse, Ted. Jesse is on the planning side. Ted is our mastermind of how we manage these properties. As I mentioned, the planning for this Carbondale and Crested Butte Trail is going to be unfolding shortly, and Jesse in particular has been hard at work on an amazing bunch of information that will be released in open houses on September 6th in Redstone, September 7th in Carbondale. It will be on the web. Everyone will have several bites at the apple to think about where the trail should go to try to connect from the BRB to Crested Butte. Questions?
I have a question.
Okay.
Is there anybody here in the audience remember seeing the train coming down from Marble with Marble on it? Besides me.
Well, I don't know. Did everyone hear that? This is Doug Ferris.
That'd be about 8 years old or more.
Doug Ferris just asked a question. Is there anyone in the room other than him who can remember that train coming down from Marble with big pieces of marble on the back of it? Okay.
Yeah.
One more time. Doug Ferris asks the question, is there anyone in the room other than him who can remember the train coming down from Marble with big chunks of marble on the back of it?
What year did they take the train tracks out?
The tracks were pulled in 1942. It's kind of an interesting thing that the steel that went into constructing that railroad was essentially mined during the war effort, and as everyone knows, in 1942 we had a big job on our hands trying to defend the free world from some folks that were trying to make it otherwise, and we needed all of that steel. So there are photographs in this book here of the salvage train coming down that line, pulling up the rails as it came. There's a beautiful scrapbook in the Marble History Museum that actually has a photograph of that train pulling into Carbondale with rails stacked up high on the back of it. And all of that steel got sent off and melted down and turned into battleships and tanks and so forth. There was an effort by Mid-Continent Coal in the 50s to reopen that rail. When they started mining again, they found that the gravel road between Coal Basin and Carbondale wasn't really allowing them to get the quantities of coal down by truck that they wanted, and they started reacquiring right away for that railroad. By that time, there had been several houses constructed right on the top of the railroad grade itself, and eventually Mid-Continent gave up. But they did lobby our senator at the time, I think it was Aspinall, to turn that road into a state highway and pave it, and that's how we now have Highway 133 was really built as a response to demand from Mid-Continent Coal to have a way to get coal in quantity down to Carbondale to the loadout over here on Catherine Store Road. Question is, are some of our alternatives for the trail going over the Ute Trail? I'm going to say that Kenny hasn't seen the alternatives for the trail because we haven't finished them yet, and so they're not out there. But you want to comment on the possibility that the trail might go on the Ute Trail?
Well, that's a good question. How do I feel about the Ute Trail? Bike trail going over to Ute Trail. Well, we can't do too much anything because a lot of the major highways are on top of the Ute Trail today. The thing of it is, even though the highways are on top of the Ute Trail all over Colorado, it basically is preserving the Ute Trail today. In some places of Colorado, there is mention, like at Rocky Mountain National Park, the highway is on top of the Ute Trail, coming down from Woodland Park into Colorado Springs. The highway is on top of the Ute Trail, coming right down into Manitou Springs, which is also a sacred site of the Ute people. The Glenwood area also has the Ute Trail coming into the town of Glenwood as well. So one of the things that as far as Ute's feelings are, is that our history is still preserved, in a sense. The markings of the trails is still identified as a Ute Trail today. One of the things that, like, let's say, for example, at Penny Hot Springs, many of you have been up there. Now, one of my friends was out here with us walking the trail, a good part of the trail, not a good part, but just certain sections. And at Penny, her partner works with GPS. And because I was mentioning some of the history there with the teepees and that area in the plains, when you're at Penny Hot Springs right here, but you're looking out in the flats, there are some teepee rings that were located there some number of years ago, 20 years ago, maybe longer, that were in that area. And you could picture the teepees in that area. She was saying that as people would be riding the trail at different pull-out stations along the trail, where it was railroad history, you hit this box on your bike, and from the GPS signal up above, it comes down into that box and you get to listen to that part of history of what happened long ago, whether it's Ute history, railroad history, redstone history, marble history. Believe it or not, there's a lot of people in this valley that do not know the marble from marble came out and has a lot of monuments from marble in Washington, D.C. Not many people know that. A few people do, but not everybody. So when you have that GPS stoppage at different areas along the bike path, people can learn that history. Because this valley is so rich in history. It really is. And until you really start looking at the history of what's here up and down the valley, you are really fortunate to be living in a history-prone area because a lot of things happen here over the globe and needs to be preserved.
I want to give a shout out for Steve and April Carver here who
Any more? Hop Greenway.
How long did the wagon road coexist with the railroad? And the petition to the county commissioners, you know, hey, they knocked down our bridge, build us another bridge. How did the ranchers deal with a railroad and wagon road being destroyed?
Well, it was pretty tense for a period of about 10 years. For example, there's a newspaper report of one of the, at that time, three county commissioners being sent up to investigate the trouble between the wagon road and the railroad. And there are places where the railroad and the wagon road are parallel, and they can't be more than 20 feet apart. Well, he came back down and reported that it's just not safe to have a team of horses hauling something on a wagon and have a steam engine go by. And so they were quite concerned to get some separation between the two. In some of those reports, and you can see it in the language of that petition, the ranchers up and down the valley were just trying to get their produce that they were growing down to markets in Carbondale, and they didn't want to pay to put it on the train. They could use the wagon road for free. Mm-hmm. Whereas once the railroad was built, you couldn't put anything on it without paying for the privilege. So eventually the thing was settled, and it's a significant question because the Elk Mountain grade had gone up the west side of the river, and Osgood bought the Elk Mountain Railroad Company and essentially said, if you guys will leave me alone with my railroad over on the east side, you can put your road on top of the grade that these guys built for a railroad that I've just bought. And they were able to get the separation that way. And that's why it is today that we've got Highway 133 going up the west side of the river, and you've got remnants of wagon road and railroad grade going up the east side.
Okay.
Davis. Did everyone hear that? The water main from Carbondale coming off of Sopris down Nettle Creek is underneath the railroad grade. And also, by the way, other utilities are as well. I think there's a phone line that goes up the railroad grade. And even out in Paloha Meadows, there are PG&E, or not PG&E, who's the phone company? There are phone boxes in the hottest places. You think you're in the wilderness, but most of that grade has got something under it. This lady in the back, and I'll come back to you, Doug.
Who owns the right-of-way for the East Mesa Ditch that starts and ends?
The East Mesa Ditch?
Yeah, because I mean, because that part of the old railroad that you were talking about that goes from Nettle Creek down to the Pine Dog.
Well, the question is, who owns the right-of-way for the East Mesa Ditch? The ownership of ditch right-of-way is in the people that are transporting the water. And so there is an East Mesa Ditch Company that once you have a water right and you divert it down to your land, you have a right to the conveyance of the water across other people's land. And that's how the ditch rights evolved. There are situations where they're owned by a single person, but in that case, they're owned by the East Mesa Ditch Company. Correct. That ditch headgate is up on the county open space at Red Wine Point, and it flows down the Crystal. It works its way up onto East Mesa above town. I think I skipped Doug. I'm going to go back to Doug, and then I'll come back to you. Oh, you pass?
That's right.
Okay.
Given the huge aversion to steep canyons, going from Marble up to the town of Crystal, do you think the trail went up that canyon or went up around Lost Trail Creek or possibly over Buell Pass?
Let's find out. I'm gonna have to toggle back through a bunch of slides to answer this question. The question is, how did the trail go up through the Devil's Punch Bowl area? And one thing I will confess up front that I don't know is how accurate,
Hayden sought to locate these trails. He did a really great job with the drainages and the elevation of the peaks and the relative location of things, but I just don't know how accurate these dotted lines are. Here's the area you're talking about, and it's just too fuzzy to see on the screen, but you can answer this question, at least where Hayden depicted it, by going back to the Atlas of 1881.
There's also a good, the Atlas, it has some drawings on, as seen on top of Mount Sopras, but what happened to those guys, they did a lot of plane table alidating, they took latitude, longitude, but when they went back to Washington, they dry labbed some of their work, the lakes, for instance, a lot of things that are a little bit distorted, but it's amazing the accuracy, at least of the Ute Trail that goes across the flat tops.
If you'll leave me your email, I'll email you this image and you can blow it up on your computer to the point where you can at least see where the trail was depicted by the Hayden survey. In the back. The question is, how did the wildlife exist back when the railroad was running and the vegetation was all torn up? I honestly don't know.
They left.
You know, some of those early trains didn't move as fast as you think of them today. The nearest we have in Colorado is the narrow gauge in Durango, Silverton, and any place where there was curvature or potential obstacles on the track, they would slow those trains right down. But I don't know about the history of wildlife populations. Tom Cardamone, you have a position on that one? Okay, talk to this man. He's our sage expert on all things wildlife. There was another question in the back.
Obviously, with the horses being introduced, the trails have become much more defined. For you guys exploring the trails, what does it say about the amount of people that were here using the trails to make such an impact that the foot trails could be followed by horse culture afterwards?
Question was about horses and foot trails. Were you utilizing that utilization of the trail?
When the horses came, it created a much more easily followable trail. What does it say about the use and the amount of people that were using the trails that they created such a trail system by foot? Was that before the horses arrived?
Up, but the Utes were the very first one to capture the horses in the 1600s because Spaniards were just coming into Santa Fe. So the Utes started utilizing a special gift horse and started traversing much more bigger territorial range of the Utes, but also utilizing that trail. Up until that point, it was basically just foot travel before the horse. Then once the Utes obtained the horses from the Spaniards, well, actually stole them from the Spaniards, then mobility became a key issue. Then as the Utes came in contact with other Indian tribes, then the trading started with the horse. Then other tribes ended up with the horse from the Utes. So there are some trails that are used by, that I've been on that are real narrow, that probably were foot trails, but you can tell that they're traveled because the sheep are still using them. Then there's also trails, areas on the flat tops where about, what, 15, 20 feet wide?
Yeah.
15, 20 feet wide in width, the trail is pretty wide where you can tell that Utes utilize the trails, particularly when you're getting ready to come into Meadow, go down into Meadow Lake. There's a real rocky area up there, and you can see it's just sheer rock, but what makes it unique is the rock is moved to the edge, so you can see this trail going through, dropping down to Meadow Lake with rock on both sides. So it gives you an idea that some trails could be just big enough for maybe 10 feet across, up to 20 feet in those areas, so it just depends on the terrain.
Hey, Dale, I just want to point out, you three gentlemen are standing on the track right now, so watch for the train. You don't know when he's coming.
Doug says the train should be coming by any minute here, right where we're standing. I have a question for Doug. Now, in the railroad book, it talks about how expensive it was to fire up one of those steam engines. And I know over in the San Juans, they addressed that problem by converting a lot of automobiles into train things that could run on rails. You've mentioned to me that there was such a thing that was running up and down this track. And I want you to describe it to everyone.
I think you're referring to the little car that we call Pinky. After the train shut off, before the rails were pulled up, Jerome Eisler up at Marble took a contract with somebody to take the mail up to Marble. And he had a little car that was built on the chassis of a Model A Ford, had a Model A Ford engine in it, and it could hold probably four or five feet, like a station wagon, basically, only he sat up there and he drove that thing on the track. And that's how they got mail to Marble, and the people in Marble could call down at the grocery store, tell them what they wanted, and we called him Rome, but his name was Jerome. Rome Eisler would bring it up on that little Pinky car. Well, that only happened probably about a year or two, because then they pulled the rails up, so couldn't do that anymore.
Have any photographs of Pinky?
I have no idea. I don't think we have any.
Wagon road, like I said, went up around the railroad. I've been on that road before. In 1958, I came home on leave from the Air Force in 1958, and it was a year that the river was rampaging, and CDOT had to close Highway 133, but the old wagon road was up around there, and I remember driving on that road and coming out right just above, or just upstream from the falls right there. So it was probably a mile or a mile and a half that they used that road for maybe 2 weeks while the river quit rampaging.
Wow.
That area Doug's talking about above Hayes Falls, I don't think there was a grade there originally. I think the river filled the bottom of that canyon, and when you look at it today with some of these super photos, I think it's pretty obvious they forced a grade down into the bottom of that canyon, but there's a reason that both you and the original wagon road had gone up over the top there. So Doug said it would flood out. Well, I think maybe we're going to call it an evening.